and that was the only call you got?
He nodded. He closed the file and picked it up again from the table.
Maud sat forward. Look, could you just sit down for 5 minutes and answer our questions? That's what this meeting is supposed to be about, isn't it?
Her voice was very controlled, but Rogers was pissed off now and made no effort to hide it. He said nothing, but pulled back the seat and sat himself into it with exaggerated patience, while color mounted in his face.
The pubs would only have been closed for half an hour, said Maud. Petty's weekend. Half of them would have had late licenses, too. But don't you think it's strange that on a Saturday night in Galway only one person saw this, and he called the station but wouldn't identify himself? Why wouldn't he give his name?
Certainly someone else may have seen your brother jump into the river. But there would be no need for them to call the police if they knew someone else had made the call, would there?
Right, fine, said Maud. Her voice was a little louder now. But you said that you lot got there in less than 10 minutes, right? So there must have been people there. People who saw Jack jump? People who gave statements?
There were some statements taken, yep, said Rogers.
This time he made no move to open his file. He was looking at Maud with poorly hidden irritation, his face more florid by the moment. Maybe he didn't like being questioned by a woman, particularly one who was younger than he was.
I'm asking you if anyone other than this anonymous caller saw Jack jump into the river.
When Rogers responded, he spoke in a monotone, listing off facts that he suddenly knew without support from the file.
When officers reached the bridge, there were a number of people in the vicinity. Two couples on the bridge were walking from the Roisin Dove pub to Supermax on the corner of Cross Street and Bridge Street. A single male was crossing the bridge from the other side, on his way home from Busker Brown's. There were a number of other people near the bridge. Only brief interviews were taken of the circumstances, and no one had seen a man enter the water.
Aisling sat forward in her chair. Her head was reeling. Maud put both hands on the table in front of her and then, as if she couldn't help herself, clenched them into fists.
This whole thing is bullshit, she said. Jack didn't kill himself. I can't believe this. All you have to say it was suicide is the word of some guy who made an anonymous call. There's not a single other person who saw it happen. She took a quick, gasping breath. You should be investigating. You need to start investigating this properly. You've gone about it all wrong. Jack's been dead for a week, and you've done nothing.
Her voice rose at the end, still not a shout, but raw and loud.
She's right,
Aisling said, hearing her own voice as if from a long way away.
This doesn't make any sense.
But Rogers was speaking over her.
That is not at all the case. The Gardaí followed the designated procedures and carried out a thorough search of the area.
Aisling felt more and more disconnected from the scene in the room. Her head was swimming. Why hadn't she asked any questions before now?
You need to look into this more. I don't think Jack was depressed. He wasn't depressed. And he was a very strong swimmer.
Rogers turned to her. He was louder now, his tone angrily condescending.
I know it's hard to accept, but people can do dreadful things. Really, I've seen it. You sit on this side of the desk for a while and you'll see what people can do. And you know, he probably drank a fair bit of alcohol before he jumped. They always do. And the alcohol would be very disorienting and make it harder to deal with the cold.
But he didn't drink, said Aisling. He had never touched alcohol in his life. He hated it, and he never took drugs.
Well, maybe he made an exception, given what was in his mind.
Rogers stood up again, this time pushing his chair back hard. It couldn't slide on the lino and so wobbled and nearly toppled backwards.
I suppose we'll never know,
he muttered.
What?
Maud said, but Rogers didn't respond.
What do you mean we won't know?
She repeated, but it seemed that Rogers was in no mood to reply. The patient teacher was long gone, replaced by a sulky schoolboy halfway between the table and the door.
No toxicology report was ordered.
His tone was triumphant.
And whose decision was that?
Maud asked. Her voice was calm now, her tone pitched low. To Aisling, she sounded like the adult in the room. Aisling's own questions, those of an hysterical teenager. The part of Aisling that wasn't dull and dizzy knew that toxicology was not a routine step in every post-mortem, that it wasn't ordered without a reason, but she couldn't find the energy to pass this information to Maud.
It's certainly not yours,
Rogers was saying. I'm his next of kin. I would like to know who decided not to test Jack's blood for drugs. I also want some answers about this anonymous caller. Has the call been traced since? There is no call box on or near O'Brien's bridge. She looked to Aisling for confirmation. Aisling shook her head, and Maud continued. No call box, so the call would have to have been made from a mobile phone. And I do not think it unreasonable for the Gardaí to take the time to carry out what seemed to me to be basic investigative steps. Rogers took hold of the door handle.
I'm sure it's very hard for you to accept your brother's death, particularly when you weren't really much of a sister to him during his life, were you really? I'm sure you're feeling a bit guilty about that. And maybe now you're trying to make up for it, that's understandable, but you know, your friend here, she's very sad about her boyfriend, and I think you'd respect that and stop trying to get her all riled up.
All riled up, Aisling repeated. She wasn't trying to be funny, but she couldn't seem to pull her thoughts together. Roger's face darkened.
Right. I've given you the information I have to give you.
He took two angry steps back to the table and shoved the grieving relative's booklet across the table at them.
Have a read of that. You'll soon see that this whole thing was textbook, you know. Most drownings in Ireland are young men in their 20s committing suicide at night with drink taken. I'm afraid I can't help you further today, and this room is needed now, so I'll have to ask you to leave.
He stood and walked to the door, holding it open for them. Maud took her time, but she stood eventually and turned to Aisling. Aisling couldn't move. She thought she might be sick. Despite the confusion and nausea, she felt that a little bit of Jack had been given back to her in this room, and if she left, she might lose him all over again. The possibility that Jack hadn't killed himself was suddenly everything. It was the thread she could pick up and follow back to a world and a life where things made sense, where their love had been real. She had to remind herself that Jack was still dead. No matter how it had happened, nothing would change the fact that he was gone. For the first time, that knowledge truly sank in, and the shock of it made her blurt out the thought that was circling around and around in her head. "But I'm pregnant," she said. She looked at Rogers, and seemingly involuntarily, Maud turned to look at him also. He spoke quite deliberately.
I'm afraid major life change can be a trigger for suicide. You'll read all about it in the booklet.
And he turned and walked out of the room. Monday, 25th of March, 2013. Chapter 6.
She's here, said Mary.
Who's here? Aisling didn't look up from her charts. She was conscious of Mary coming closer, looking over her shoulder and starting to read. Checking up on me? Aisling asked, still not looking up.
Nope, just interested.
Aisling ignored her, kept writing. Mary had been so supportive, but since the funeral the support seemed to have an edge to it. As if Mary felt that the fact that Aisling hadn't completely collapsed was in some way letting Jack down. Aisling found she liked the old, sarcastic, pissy Mary much more than the new, uber-empathetic version. The overt sympathy made her feel claustrophobic. I told Sandra to ask her to take a seat in the waiting room. Who? She wished, fervently, that Mary would go away. She had an hour to get through the charts, and needed two. There was so much to catch up on. She wouldn't have believed she could fall this far behind in a week. She would be doing rounds with Cummins in the morning, and he was unbelievably anal about charting. He was due to mark her for assessment, and she wasn't going to give him any excuses to mark her down. What's her name? You know, Jack's sister. What? Aisling looked up. Finally, a reaction. She's sitting in the waiting room. Not much like Jack, is she? Skinny thing.
Aisling was already standing and moving towards the double doors, charts abandoned. It had been 3 days since the family liaison meeting. She should have called Maud at her hotel. Bad enough that she'd virtually run from that bloody meeting, hadn't waited long enough to exchange even a polite goodbye. Worse that she'd made no effort to contact her since. Maud wasn't in the seating area. Had she left already? But no. She was standing, arms wrapped around herself, and looking out of the window at the dull afternoon. The view of the car park was not inspiring at the best of times. On a dark winter's day, it was a bloody health hazard. If you weren't depressed when you reached the waiting room, you probably would be by the time you left it. Maud. Maud turned. Had she been that thin when Aisling saw her at the police station? She'd seemed strong then. Now she looked pale, depleted. That girl they just brought in. The one with all the blood on her face and clothes? Did she try to kill herself? Maud asked. What? No, nothing like that. She had her tonsils out last week, then got an infection. She had a hemorrhage. Aisling found herself giving a little laugh. It looked dramatic, but she'll be fine. Why was she telling Maud all of this, and in an open waiting room? So much for patient confidentiality. Maud nodded. Do you have time for coffee? Aisling glanced towards the double doors. I shouldn't, she said. I'm on for another few hours. She looked back at Maud. We're pretty quiet. I can probably take half an hour, as long as I take the bleep. She patted the pager tucked inside her scrub's top pocket. The canteen will be closed, but there's a cafe across the road. I can meet you there in half an hour. Mary all but pushed Aisling out the door, so she restacked her charts, grabbed her puffer, and walked quickly out of A&E, across the car park and College Road, and into the cafe. It was a functional sort of place, but the coffee was decent and it was in range for the pager. Maud sat at a table, two cups in front of her.
I ordered you a black coffee, but there's milk on the table.
She gestured towards the milk jug and sugar.
I thought you'd probably want it strong.
Thanks. Aisling sat and took the cup. She added sugar and milk with an apologetic smile and then felt awkward. She felt ill at ease in nearly every social interaction at the moment, too conscious of every expression that crossed her face. She was editing herself, reviewing her own expressions, adapting them to something appropriate for someone whose partner had just killed himself. You look cold, she said. Maud was still wearing her coat and scarf, had her arms wrapped around herself. She looked down in seeming surprise, then released her arms and wrapped her hands around her cup.
It's autumn at home, but still pretty warm. Nothing like this.
Where's home? Aisling asked.
Australia, Maud said. The Kimberley.
She checked herself and shook her head.
Used to be, I mean, not anymore.
Did you live there long? The question felt ridiculous, the smallest of small talk. Maud shrugged.
Longer than I lived in Ireland.
Right. They fell silent for a moment, both taking sips of coffee. Aisling studied Maud as they sat there. Her dark hair was long, tied in a careless knot at the back of her head. She wore a grey wool coat that looked a size too big. She was very attractive. A middle-aged Audrey Hepburn? Except she must only be in her 30s. What, 35? She looked older.
I'm sorry I didn't stay, Aisling said. After the meeting, I had an appointment.
She finished lamely. I'm sure you'd like to talk, and I'd like to too. Could we meet again, when I'm not working, before you go back to Australia?
I'm not going back, Maud said, surprise in her voice. My life in Australia? Things have changed there. I'm going to stay in Ireland.
I see. How tragic, then, that she'd waited too long. If returning to Ireland had been a possibility, why hadn't she come before now? Perhaps Jack hadn't meant that much to her.
I'd like to know what you think happened, Maud said.
To Jack?
A nod.
I don't know.
But you don't believe that he killed himself?
I don't know. It seems crazy to suggest anything else happened, but Jack wasn't depressed. He could get down and out sometimes like anyone, but he wasn't depressed.
So, nothing had happened in your lives? Nothing that would have upset him in some way?
Aisling shook her head, stared back at Maud.
She wasn't going to mention the pregnancy. If Maud wanted to ask if Jack could have killed himself because she was carrying his child, she could bloody well come out with it herself.
Yes, Aisling had spent the best part of the week believing it herself.
But she would never say it out loud again.
Maud's face was unreadable. Eventually, she said,
If Jack didn't kill himself, then what? An accident?
She paused.
Murder?
Jesus, no.
Maud sat, watching her and waiting.
There's no way. I mean, Jack didn't have any enemies or anything like that. He was just an ordinary guy.
Stupid thing to say. Jack hadn't been ordinary. He had been so very special.
You can't think of anyone who might have wanted to hurt him?
Aisling shook her head again. Tears stung her eyes and she blinked them back, then closed her eyes against the sudden, vivid memory of Jack, the first time she'd realized she loved him. They'd been in college, had been dating a few months, hadn't felt like anything serious. She'd been in the library studying and had met him afterwards, had seen him walking towards her across the quad. She'd watched his face light up when he saw her, his eyes fill with laughter at some story he had to tell her. Jack had gathered her to him in a great bear hug, then kissed her, put her down and started talking. And that was the moment, as she held his hand and walked with him through the college, listening, that she realized she loved him. Something in her recognized how right it was with Jack, long before her brain could capture it and analyze it. Trying to explain him made him sound less than he was, she found. Describing him as a good man, kind, strong, independent, but supportive. It all added up to something far more anemic than the real thing. So she gave up on trying to explain it to her friends, to her mostly absent family who thought she was too young to settle down, and just enjoyed it. He told her his story the first time he brought her home to meet his parents. That Aggie and Brendan were his adoptive parents, that his mother was dead, his father unknown. He had a sister somewhere, but hadn't seen her since he was a little boy and didn't know where she was. All of it delivered matter-of-factly, with a smile that invited her to treat it lightly, as old pain long put away. She'd asked him about his scars later, the three round burn marks on his left shoulder, and he'd told her, not smiling now, that he didn't remember getting them. Something about the tightness in his shoulders made her wonder if he was lying, but she'd kissed him and let it go. Had she let too much go? Noticed too little? Aisling blinked her way back to the present and found that Maud was watching her.
You think someone killed him, don't you?
Aisling asked. Maud nodded slowly.
Why?
You knew him best, Aisling. You know his friends. The people he works with, the places he goes. You need to think about who could have hurt him, who had reason to want Jack dead.
I'll have to go to the police again, push them to take this seriously. That guy Rogers is a joke, but there must be someone else.
The coffee cup had cooled in Aisling's hand, though it was more than half full. She checked the pager in her pocket, though it had been silent throughout their conversation. So strange to be there with Jack's sister talking about his death, as the sky darkened outside. Maud's dark eyes, so like Jack's, but different too. Maud was less joyful, more cautious, harder to read.
If you're going to take this further, then it would be better to work together, I think,
Maud said. At that, the pager started to buzz. Aisling muted it. Her head ached.
Maybe I'm just in denial. I don't want Jack to have killed himself. Murder? There's just no way.
But we need the Gardaí to look at this properly, just for peace of mind.
It sounded like a plea. She tried to make her voice stronger, more confident.
There's a Garda ombudsman, I think, that you can go to with complaints.
Maud hesitated, then shook her head firmly. I have evidence, she said. Evidence that I think proves that the story the police gave us is bullshit.
Aisling felt hot, then cold. What sort of evidence?
Maud smiled for the first time. The best kind. Video.
Chapter 7. It was Peter Fisher who first mentioned the case. Cormac was on his way back from a late lunch and met him in the stairwell.
I hear you've caught one, said Fisher.
Cormac raised an eyebrow.
The super wants you in his office. Looks like you've picked one up.
Cormac tried to hide his relief, but knew he had failed when Fisher gave him an encouraging grin.
Fuck's sake.
Cormac gave him a brisk nod of acknowledgement and restrained himself from taking the rest of the stairs two at a time. He felt the same rush of excitement and adrenaline he always felt, this time complicated by a need to prove himself that he hadn't experienced in years. Cormac knocked on the door of Brian Murphy's office. He didn't wait, but opened the door and entered. A pair of cycling shoes and a helmet sat on a shelf. Murphy was 10 years older than Cormac, but he was probably in better shape. He was lean, very lean, and fit, and kept his thinning hair cut close to his scalp. He was sitting behind his desk, and he raised one hand in a wait gesture while he finished reading whatever was on his screen. His desk, oversized but standard issue white melamine, was immaculate and completely free of paper. The computer screen, keyboard and phone were pushed slightly to Murphy's right, and a grey cold case file box sat on the far left of the desk.
Shite. Another bloody cold case.
Murphy looked up.
Riley, he said. Take a seat.
He opened the cold case box and took out a thin file.
Settling in?
He asked, but continued without waiting for a reply.
Not missing the elite confines of Dublin Castle, are you?
No, sir, said Cormac.
Of course he bloody missed it. He'd been the youngest Garda ever admitted to the Special Detective Unit, and he'd made a success of it. Requesting the transfer had seemed logical to him at the time. The peace process had been successful. A ceasefire had been in place for years, and the unit was a shadow of its former self. There were new threats, of course, but it was obvious to the dogs on the street that the anti-terrorist unit was about to be restructured, which really meant downsized. And then there was Emma. She was a research scientist, a biologist. When she'd won a highly prestigious grant from the European Research Council, he'd been there with champagne on ice. When she'd explained that the grant was worth $3 million a year and was intended to fund the cost of 8 researchers who would work under Emma on a project she had designed, he had been delighted for her. And when she'd explained that the lab was at the university in Galway, he had, he thought, been effective in hiding his dismay. When he'd ultimately decided to look for a transfer out of the Special Detectives Unit to the Galway operations, a step down in the eyes of everyone who knew anything about it, there had been the predictable slagging, plenty of whipped comments. Cormac didn't give a shit. The fact that the unit would likely be restructured within the year took the pain out of his decision. But he would have made the decision either way. In the face of Emma's concerns that he would miss Dublin and his job, he'd been unrelentingly optimistic, and reality had taken time to hit. But after a month working on no-hoper cold cases, a month of returning to an empty flat with Emma working late on some project deadline or other, a month where the rain pissed down relentlessly every day, regret was beginning to kick in with a vengeance.
I've heard good things about you, Riley,
the super was saying.
You've done very well.
And that was patronizing as fuck. Was the intent to needle him? Or to poke and measure him by his reaction? He didn't know enough about Murphy to be sure. Brian Murphy was more administrator than cop, and that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. Word on the street was that he was good at his job, a straight shooter,
Or at least as much of one as the job would allow. Cormac still wondered how he handled having his son work out of the same station while said son hung out of Anthony Healy's pocket. It couldn't be comfortable for him. Under normal circumstances, Trevor would never have been able to work out of a station that was under his father's command. But as the National Drugs Unit reported up to the Assistant Commissioner, Crime and Security, rather than through the Western Region command structure, Trevor wasn't technically under his father's leadership. The super had to know about Healy's reputation. If Murphy felt the pressure of the situation, he'd hit it well.
You know your transfer here is part of a broader effort to decentralize some of our specialist skills out of elite units and back into operations. The intent is that you share, particularly with your younger colleagues, some of what you learnt in the SDU. But, of course, we do things differently in Galway. So you will have to adjust and learn to follow our processes.
He paused, looking at Cormac as if considering him deeply.
I've no doubt, with your level of commitment, you'll be one of our top men in no time.
Yes, sir. Christ almighty, he'd seen nothing yet that impressed him about Galway's best detectives.
You're about to get a little busier, Murphy said,
and he opened the file on his desk.
Sir?
The file looked old, but in good condition. An elastic band had been placed around it at some point, but it had rotted off, leaving only an outline on the cardboard. As Murphy opened the file, Cormac saw that it contained no more than 20 or 30 pages.
Hilaria Blake,
Murphy said.
You investigated her death. What? On the 21st of February 1993, you went to a house in answer to a call. When you got there, you found two children and their dead mother. The dead woman was Hilaria Blake.
Murphy closed the file and pushed it across the desk to Cormac.
Your notes are unusually complete, given your inexperience at the time. I gather you had suspicions about the death. You thought it may have been something other than an accidental overdose.
Cormac hesitated, then opened the file. He scanned the first page as memories came flooding back.
It was a call out for a domestic dispute, or at least that's what we thought. I wouldn't have been sent out otherwise, I was so green.
He looked up from the file.
My concerns. I raised those questions with my superior back in 93. He did not agree. The case has been closed for 20 years.
Cormac thought back, remembering the response of, what was the guy's name?
It was gone.
He could recall very clearly, though, the complete lack of interest in carrying out any sort of investigation. If it hadn't been for him, a file might not even have been opened. And he'd been directed to bring the thing to an end in no time at all. In truth, there had been nothing to go on. Nothing except Cormac's gut feeling that something worse than the obvious had been going on in that house, and the fact that the post-mortem indicated that Hilaria Blake had not been a habitual heroin user.
I want you to reopen the file,
Murphy said. Cormac said nothing, but stared at his new boss, waiting. There must be something more.
Jack Blake, the boy you found that night, is dead. He appears to have committed suicide, but his sister, Maud, has returned to Galway. As I understand it, she ran away on the night of her mother's death. Now she has returned, and her brother is dead also, again in suspicious circumstances. I want this looked into, and you are the best man for the job. Sir, I'm flattered. Are you?
Murphy cut across him.
This is not a compliment to your abilities, detective. You are simply in the right place at the right time. You were the only person in this station who was present at the time of Hilaria Blake's death. You worked out of Swinford at the time, is that right?
He didn't wait for Cormac's nod.
You met the children. You carried out at least some sort of preliminary investigation. You are, after all, an experienced detective. I am reopening this case and I want you to run the investigation.
Cormac turned the pages on the file, scanning its content, looking for something new, something that could have prompted Murphy to call in a 20-year-old suspicious death file. He saw forms filled in with his own writing, reports signed by him, hospital records and post-mortem results. But nothing new. And nothing to link what should be a Mayo investigation to Galway. Except, of course, Jack Blake's death.
Talk to me about this woman. About Maud Blake, Murphy said. What do you know about her?
I've nothing to tell you, sir. I don't know anything about her,
Cormac said.
I was with her for about 3 hours 20 years ago. She wasn't much more than a child.
She's not a child now, said Murphy. She's a woman of some means, apparently. She lives somewhere in Australia, or at least that's where she flew in from. She's staying in an expensive hotel. So the question I have is, how does a 15-year-old with no family and no money flee the country and not just survive, but apparently thrive? I have no idea, but she'd hardly be the first from difficult circumstances to make the most of her life.
Cormac kept his tone cool, though he felt a surge of irritation.
You recognized her?
Sir?
You saw her coming out of the family room, and you told Garda McIntyre that you knew her.
Mystery woman. Of course. He was surprised he had recognized her at all after 20 years, but that night, and Maud, had stayed with him for a long time. And Danny'd gone off his own bat to find out who she was. Probably thought he was doing him a favor. Fucking Danny.
I didn't recognize her. I thought she looked familiar. I couldn't recall where I knew her from, so I asked Danny McIntyre to find out for me. I don't know anything about who she is today. I met her when she was a girl, a teenager. She called the station and I was asked to respond to the call. We weren't expecting to find what I found. I took her and her little brother to the hospital. That's it, really?
Murphy waited.
She disappeared from the hospital.
Left her brother behind. Cormac paused, thinking again about the little boy's despair. Had Maud ever come back to see him?
In the post-mortem report, the pathologist said that the mother, Hilaria, did not show any signs of using heroin, that that night might have been her first time. She was an alcoholic and had advanced liver disease. You clearly had suspicions of foul play,
Murphy said, gesturing to the file.
I raised it with my DS at the time,
Cormac said. I felt that it was a suspicious death and we should make further inquiries.
He disagreed.
Cormac paused.
The little boy was in a bad state. Hilaria Blake was very obviously not a model mother. There was no appetite for an investigation. Different times.
They had been, truly, different times. In 1993, Brendan Smith, a former priest and notorious child abuser, was still on the run in Ireland, the true extent of his crimes not known. The documentaries States of Fear and Suing the Pope, which did so much to prompt long overdue government inquiries, had not yet been screened, and those inquiries had not yet been held. In the 20 years since the Blake case, Ireland had woken up. But Cormac could remember the days when the welfare of a child was not the first consideration in a child protection case, when investigating the death of an unmarried mother and drug addict would never have been high on the Garda agenda.
Sir, are you suggesting that Maud Blake may have had something to do with her brother's death? I don't believe I said that, Detective, and I'm not implying it either. Do you understand?
Cormac nodded. The only acceptable response in the face of bureaucratic bullshit. None of this made sense, and Murphy had to know that as well as he did. Wasn't it Jack's death had prompted this investigation?
Am I to look into Jack Blake's death?
He asked.
That investigation is being handled by other officers, Murphy said, and you're to leave that work to them.
Cormac kept his face blank. Murphy must suspect Maud. Why else would he have started looking into her past? But if that was the case, it made no sense to split the investigation. Murphy was watching him, Cormac realized, reading him, or trying to. Murphy slapped one hand on his desk, as if punctuating his decision.
I want you on this case, Riley, he said. You are the investigating officer. You decide when to bring Blake in, when to question her. Is that understood?
The phrasing was odd. Did Murphy think Cormac would shirk the case? Try to palm it off on a subordinate? He had no intention of it. Murphy might be an asshole, that remained to be seen. But if he was, he was the asshole Cormac had to impress if he wanted to keep his career.
Yes, sir.
Murphy dropped the file back into the box and pushed it in Cormac's direction.
Preliminary report by Friday, please, Detective Sergeant.
Chapter 8. Cormac walked out of the office, thinking about the little boy he had last seen in a hospital room 20 years ago. He'd kept track of Jack for some time, and had been relieved when he was told that Jack had gone straight from hospital to a foster family. Relieved and surprised that a family had been found so quickly. The foster family had gone on to adopt Jack, and it had really seemed that he had every chance of leaving his childhood behind him. If he had killed himself, that was a tragedy. Maybe the abuse he'd suffered had hurt him too much, had come back to destroy him in the end. Cormac dropped the file on his desk and flipped it open. If Murphy thought there was a chance Jack had been murdered, why hadn't he put Cormac on that case, instead of a 20-year-old suspicious death that had long since been written off as an accidental overdose? There was an agenda at play here, but whatever it was wasn't clear. Cormac looked towards the other end of the room, then closed the file and walked over. The place was almost empty. The drugs unit must be out on a job. Everyone but Danny. Carrie O'Halloran, the man-hater, was seated at a desk in the corner, her head bent over her paperwork. Danny didn't look up at Cormac's approach. Cormac put one hand on Danny's desk, lowered his voice, and spoke almost into his ear.
I just had an interesting little chat with our friend Murphy.
Danny jumped.
Jesus!
Cormac just looked at him.
About?
About Maud Blake. I think you've dropped me in it. I've got yet another cold case because Murphy thinks I have some sort of inside knowledge.
Danny's face flushed.
You're investigating her brother's suicide? I bloody wish. No. Cold cases only for me, it seems. I'm looking into Hilaria Blake's death. A 20-year-old accidental death, heroin overdose.
Danny looked confused for a moment, as well he might. The flush faded slowly from his cheeks.
Sorry, mate. All I did was ask Rogers who he was talking to. He asked who wanted to know. I said you thought you'd recognized her.
Cormac sat on the desk beside Danny's.
I'm missing something, he said. Murphy didn't come right out and say it, but he suggested that there's something suspicious about Jack Blake's death. I got the impression that's what prompted Murphy's sudden interest in Hilaria Blake. But if that was it, then why am I on the cold case?
Danny shook his head.
I heard it was suicide, pretty cut and dry.
You haven't heard anything else?
Sorry. Maybe you took Murphy up wrong.
Maybe.
Danny was distracted, Cormac realized. He looked tired, strained.
Any news on Lorna?
Danny shook his head.
Nothing. I've tried calling that friend I spoke to, but she's not answering her phone.
You're worried?
Danny shook his head.
Nah. Paranoid, maybe, because of all the bullshit. But I know she's fine.
Danny had lowered his voice, and he glanced around the room as he spoke. He didn't want to get into it there, and Cormac couldn't blame him.
Where's the rest of the task force?
Cormac asked. Danny checked his watch.
They're down in the case room planning an operation. It's the same thing we worked through yesterday and the day before that, he said. Healy likes to over-prepare.
Is there a problem?
Danny met his eyes.
If you mean, am I not Mr. Popular with the unit? Nothing new there.
Do you want to do something about that?
Like what?
Like, tell me whatever you have on Anthony Healy. Let me do something about it.
Danny grimaced, shook his head.
If I did know something, and I'm not saying I do, I'd torpedo my career if I talked about it. Anthony Healy and Trevor Murphy are thick as thieves. I go to internal affairs about Healy.
He held up one hand, palm facing Cormac.
If I had something, that is. And apart from getting that reputation so that no cop trusts me again, Trevor goes straight to his daddy. Where would that leave me?
Cormac hesitated, the squad room not being the best place for this conversation. And then the opportunity passed, as Healy, Murphy Jr., and the two uniforms temporarily assigned to the task force arrived back. Healy stared at Cormac as he settled back into his chair. There was a challenge there that Cormac thought he would have to deal with sooner or later. Cormac looked away, straight into the eyes of Carrie O'Halloran, who was watching the exchange with unembarrassed interest. O'Halloran. He'd asked around about her since his conversation with Danny. She'd worked her entire career in Galway, so it was difficult to get any meaningful information. But she'd once worked a case with a friend of his, Sean Hegarty, who'd come down to provide support on a suspected sex trafficking ring. The friend had said she was competent, efficient, not overly friendly. She was also young for her rank, and there had been rumors that her promotion was political. Not exactly consistent with Danny's view of her, but then Danny'd worked with her longer. Best to make up his own mind. Cormac gave her a civil nod, which she ignored, returning her attention to her computer. Fantastic. Cormac went back to his desk to find an overtime report from Fisher awaiting his signature. He was claiming 6 hours at weekend rates for the Lanigan case. Cormac signed it, knowing he'd have to justify the use of overtime on a cold case at the next finance meeting, for which he'd probably get a bullocking. He hadn't even caught up with Fisher yet. Had been meaning to all day, but somehow it had gotten away from him. He had a pile of paperwork to work through, the price he paid for spending most of the previous week out and about following up on leads. He got to work, became absorbed in it, and when he finally looked up from the files, he found that the room had emptied out, and twilight was setting in. It was the buzzing of his phone that had broken his focus, and he reached for it. A text from Emma. Sorry, sorry. Late again. Tomorrow night? Kiss, kiss. Shite. Another evening of TV and cooking for one was suddenly unappealing. It was only Monday. He should go to the gym. Bad habit to get into, though. Pint, he said to Danny. Danny rolled his eyes, then shrugged. Yeah, man so. Cormac returned to his desk and locked the Blake file into the drawer under his desk before putting on his coat. The drawer wasn't remotely secure. It could be picked by a 5-year-old with a fork. But the file was hardly sensitive, and putting it away would at least keep it from the casual curiosity of a contract cleaner. Cormac hesitated, looking down at the locked file drawer. This was certainly the first time he'd walked out of the station without even opening the file on a new case. Was he losing his appetite for the job? Had his willingness to walk away from the SDU been a symptom of burnout on the way? He snorted, turned for the stairs. No. This was just a piece of shit case, and he had no desire to start work on another time waster. Peter Fisher caught up with them on their way down the stairs. Coat in hand, he was obviously finished for the day.
So, what's the story? He said. Did you get a case?
Danny gave him a look that clearly said, none of your fucking business. But Fisher didn't irritate Cormac, despite the fact that he was perpetually cheerful. He was smart, he was motivated, and if he didn't have much respect for hierarchy, Cormac could sympathize with that.
If you could call it a case, Cormac said and continued down the stairs. Is it that suicide thing then? The thing Rogers is on?
Fisher asked.
Related, Cormac said.
Then, catching the look on Fisher's face,
Why? What did you hear? You haven't heard the story?
Fisher asked. He looked around, his face a perfect mix of excitement at having something juicy to share and nervousness at being overheard. Cormac didn't hesitate.
We're going for pints, he said. King's Head, will you join us?
The pub was quiet. On Friday, the place would be packed with office workers celebrating the end of another week of the grind. But on a Monday evening at 6 o'clock, it had a bare scattering of patrons, and the background music was quiet enough for comfortable conversation. Danny led the way to the back bar and claimed a table by slinging his jacket over the back of a chair.
What'll you have?
He asked. Danny got the pints and came back with menus.
Sarah won't expect you home?
Cormac asked, taking a menu and scanning it.
She'll get over it,
Danny said dryly. Cormac didn't ask a follow-up, though Danny's tone begged the question. If he was going to have that conversation, and he was going to do his damnedest to avoid it, it wouldn't be in front of Fisher. They ordered food and settled back, Cormac letting his eyes wander around the room. King's Head was a big place. It wasn't their usual haunt, but he'd wanted somewhere they wouldn't be overheard, where they could get a table a reasonable distance from the next punter. The table Danny had chosen was just the right distance from the fireplace. Close enough to enjoy the heat and the flickering light, not so close that you'd be melting after half an hour. The pints were good, and food was on the way. Suddenly Cormac felt very much at home. He sent a text to Emma, told her he was eating out, and got a reply seconds later. Perfect. Date night tomorrow? Kiss, kiss, kiss. Maybe he'd book somewhere decent. It didn't take them long to get into it.
I don't know that much, Fisher said. Someone saw the guy Jack take a dive from O'Brien's bridge, called it in. Car was out in under 8 minutes. No sign of him, so they mobilized the search team. They didn't find him until the sun came up after 9 the following morning. He'd been washed out, but the tide was coming back in, and he was found at Loch Atoilia, pronounced at the scene and taken to UCHG.
Cormac nodded and tried not to think about the little boy whose hand he had held 20 years before. The past 20 years had taught him a lot, including the necessity of keeping his distance from a case. You couldn't carry the emotional load for the victims. If you did, you were less effective as a police officer and you burned out. But he'd been in his first month on the job when he'd met Maud and Jack, and Hilaria Blake was the first dead body he'd seen. Jack Blake's face became a symbol for every neglected and abused child he came across in his career. What had caused Jack to take his own life, if that was what had happened? Maybe it had nothing to do with his early experience.
So, the guy was pretty clean-cut, it seems, Fisher was saying. Not a drinker, didn't do drugs, had a good job and lived with his girlfriend. She's a doctor, works at UCHG.
Cormac nodded, listening, but his eyes wandered across the room. Carrie O'Halloran had just walked in and taken a seat. She was alone. She hadn't looked at them, but he had a feeling she knew they were there. Fisher's eyes were bright, and he was leaning forward across the table, his voice pitched low. He wasn't hard to read. Something more interesting was coming down the track.
Anyway, Rogers, if you'll believe it, was assigned to family liaison. Can you believe that?
Fisher raised both hands in the air in an exaggerated gesture of surprise.
Fucking Rogers. Kerry is his second on it. She said the girlfriend is in total shock, so not really making things difficult. The parents are pretty old, the dad in a wheelchair, so they're leaving everything to the girlfriend. So, you know, despite Rogers being about as sensitive as Jesus, I don't know, you've met him. He's as thick as pig shite.
Cormac gave a small smile but shook his head. Rogers did strike him as a particularly bad choice. Family liaison officers were female more often than not, which he'd always thought was a bit sexist, and they were generally expected to have good interpersonal skills and to be personally presentable. Rogers was an old-style guard, and in Cormac's view, should never have made sergeant. His personal hygiene was also seriously lacking. Fisher took another drink from his pint, realized he was finished, and stood up to get around. Danny hadn't said much since they'd entered the bar, and when Cormac looked across at him, he rolled his eyes.
What? I didn't realize we were babysitting tonight.
Danny, if he's got the inside track about my case, I need to hear about it.
Danny rolled his eyes.
Maybe Murphy's messing with you, pulling out an old case you were hung up on, winding you up and watching you go.
Cormac raised an eyebrow.
Bit of a stretch.
Danny returned his attention to his pint, and Cormac did the same. It wouldn't kill Danny to have a pint with Fisher. They were the same rank after all, though maybe that was part of the problem. Cormac occupied himself by watching Carrie O'Halloran while Danny brooded. She'd ordered a glass of red and was taking her time with it. She had a file open in front of her. The jacket was blue, so it wasn't a murder file. Galway had its own color coding. What was blue again? Domestic violence? Danny's gaze followed Cormac's to where O'Halloran sat, and he grimaced.
Whatever you do, don't ask her to join us too.
You're sure you're not worried?
About Lorna?
Then, at Cormac's nod,
I don't know, Cormac. A bit, I suppose.
I can't get that girl on the phone.
Who?
The hippie. Ditsy Wona gave me the story about the music festival.
Where is she? Where is she based?
Dublin.
You should go up. Go tomorrow. Track the girl down. Talk to her in person.
Danny blew out a breath.
I should, I know. Maybe I will.
He looked away.
It's just, I'm trying to make something of this transfer, you know? I just know I'm going to trek all the way to Dublin, screw up my work, and then find that little idiot laughing it up with our friends.
Danny.
I know, I know.
Danny drank from his pint, refusing to look at Cormac. Cormac let his eyes drift over to O'Halloran again. She was sipping her wine, reading her file as if totally engrossed. She hadn't looked their way once, which was enough to tell Cormac that she knew they were there. Fisher returned with pints from the bar at the same time as the waitress arrived with their food. They ate, and by unspoken agreement, conversation was restricted to small talk until the last forkful had been eaten and another round had been ordered at the bar.
So, Rogers is family liaison, then?
Cormac said eventually. Fisher nodded.
It was at the last meeting that the sister showed up. No one was expecting her by all accounts, not even the girlfriend. She lives in Australia or something, hadn't been in touch with her brother for years, but she showed up for this meeting, full of attitude and questions. She doesn't believe her brother did it. Killed himself.
Danny rolled his eyes again. But Cormac, thinking of a 15-year-old Maud carrying her little brother from their home, said,
Not unusual. A lot of family members are in denial in those circumstances. Hard thing to accept.
Fisher nodded again, leaned forward across the table and dropped his voice. It was so melodramatic that Cormac had to restrain himself from joining Danny in yet another eye roll. But what Fisher had to say next caught his attention.
Yeah, but I hear she had good questions, and she wasn't very happy that Rogers had no answers.
He paused.
She showed up at the station again this afternoon, this time with a memory stick loaded with CCTV footage of the bridge.
She did what?
Cormac asked. Danny didn't look surprised. He must have heard the story before. Fisher sat back into his seat, a smile on his face, satisfied with the reaction he was getting.
She walked both sides of the bridge, found everywhere that had a camera up, and somehow talked them into giving her copies. Anyway, she got it, watched it, and found that there was no sign of her brother coming from either direction for 2 hours before he was supposed to have gone into the water. And the phone call reporting the jump? No sign of the caller either, but plenty of other people on camera just before the call was made. Some of them were still there when our people arrived and took statements. They all said that they saw nothing.
Jesus. She got that in what? 24 hours?
Cormac asked.
Yeah, got it, viewed it, edited it into one film. When she wasn't happy with Roger's reaction, she said she'd send it directly to the coroner's office, then to the press.
You can imagine, Murphy had a fucking coronary.
Fisher was laughing now.
Jesus,
said Cormac again, imagining the scene. He'd had the briefest glance of Maud in the family room, and his memory of her as a girl kept overlaying itself over the more recent memory of the woman in the police station.
She's not messing around.
Fisher shrugged, grinned.
Rogers didn't tell you all that,
Cormac said. Fisher shook his head emphatically.
No way. Kerry was there. She filled me in.
She's still on the job?
Fisher shrugged.
Just part of the liaison team with Rogers, but she said Rogers was pretty clear that there won't be an investigation, even with the CCTV.
Fuck's sake, said Danny. Why would there be? Chances are the guy jumped from another bridge, and whoever called it in got the name of the bridge wrong. I said as much to Rogers.
He checked his watch.
Mountain out of a molehill.
Cormac watched Danny drain his glass.
Think so?
Cormac asked.
Danny shrugged and stood. Nothing to me either way, mate.
He caught a not very subtle sideways glance at Fisher.
I'm off. I've an early one tomorrow.
Cormac nodded, watched him leave, made a mental note to tackle him again on the Healy issue sooner rather than later. He turned to Fisher.
So, what's your take? You think we should investigate?
Fisher spoke in the direction of his empty glass, avoiding Cormac's eye.
Not going to happen,
he said.
If Rogers is saying there'll be no investigation, that's coming from upstairs. Even with the CCTV, I don't think they're taking this very seriously.
And with that, Fisher perhaps felt he'd said enough. The conversation wrapped up, and neither of them showed any sign of wanting to stay for another one. When Cormac looked across the room, Carrie O'Halloran was already gone. Chapter 9. Aisling's shift ended at 8 p.m., and by 5:30 she was in the lift at the Radisson Hotel, heading up to the 5th floor. She felt shaky. Hunger was the main culprit. Her only break had been the 20 minutes she had taken with Maud, and that hadn't been the moment to wolf her usual sandwich. But she was nervous, too. Her concentration had been shot to pieces for the afternoon, and it had been a relief when her shift ended. When she reached the door, she paused to take a breath before knocking. Maud opened the door, a glass of wine in her hand. She wore a soft navy cardigan, open over a pristine white-fitted t-shirt and skinny jeans. Her feet were bare.
"You were a little earlier than I was expecting," she said.
Not the warmest of greetings, but she stepped inside to invite Aisling into the room. It was a small suite, with wooden floors, a grey velvet couch, and 2 blue, uncomfortable-looking armchairs. Aisling walked across thick, soft carpet to the window.
The hotel backed onto Loch Atoilia.
During the day, this room would have a view out over the water, which wasn't a lake at all, but a tidal inlet. The Corrib, which ran deep and fast through the center of the city, emptied into the bay just west of the inlet. Aisling stared out of the window, past the dull glow of the street lamps below, to the dark, unseen water beyond. The water that Jack had died in. Was that what Maud thought about when she woke here every morning and looked out of her window? A gust of wind lashed rain against the window, and Aisling turned away.
"There's wine if you'd like it, or water, if you prefer," Maud said.
The armchairs had been set up to face a small round table, and she sat and waited for Aisling to join her. Maud's laptop was open on the table, and the arrangement felt curiously like a business meeting. Aisling folded her coat over the back of her chair. There was a small gas fireplace in the room, switched on, and poured a glass of water from a full pitcher. As she took her seat, it occurred to her that Maud had said nothing yet about her pregnancy.
"You said something about a video," she asked,
and then felt gauche. She just couldn't bring herself to make small talk. But Maud was nodding. She took a sip from her wine glass, turned the laptop so they could both see the screen, then smoothed her hair nervously with one hand. "After that meeting, I was angry. I went for coffee and started to think it all through. The story didn't sound right to me. Jack died on the Saturday night of St. Patrick's weekend. It would have been incredibly busy in town, packed with tourists. Don't you think it sounded odd? That Jack could have jumped into the water, and just a few minutes later not a single person was on the bridge who had seen him jump? If you saw someone jump into the river, would you just shrug and keep walking? Or would you stay, lean over the wall, try to spot them, direct the rescuers?" Maud didn't wait for an answer. "It was all I could think about once I left the meeting." Aisling nodded slowly.
"It can be busy at night. And it would have been busier than usual that weekend. But the police aren't claiming no one was there. They interviewed people, took statements.
Not from anyone who saw Jack jump. Anyway, I started to look around, and I found some cameras. I got the CCTV footage and went through it all."
Maud opened the laptop and hit a key to wake it up.
"How did you..."
But Aisling let her voice trail off as she watched Maud log into the computer and open a screen that showed grainy black-and-white images of people walking on a city street.
"This is the camera in front of the newsagents, the one at the very end of Bridge Street, just before the bridge itself starts," Maud was saying. "This is the clearest of them."
The camera was focused on the area immediately outside the shop's door and window. Most of the image was filled with a stretch of footpath, but the angle allowed Aisling a view of the faces of the passers-by. She watched people in groups of 2s and 3s, walking in either direction. Most of them were young. The picture was unbelievably clear, and Aisling could see faces laughing, talking, even arguing as they passed, oblivious, under the camera.
I have footage showing three of the four approaches to the bridge. I've watched 2 hours of film from 10:30 p.m. to 12:30 a.m. That is, the hour before and after the phone call was made. There's nothing. I couldn't see anyone who looks like Jack. You should look at everything, too, of course. I don't think I could have missed him, but it would be better if we could say that you checked the videos. I can give it all to you on a stick. Anyway, if you keep watching, the videos show the Gardaí arriving and leaving. Maud clicked a button and the screen split in two. Aisling watched as, on one side of the picture, two police cars rushed in and out of view, and on the other, a group of three people turned and looked back in the direction of the bridge. A reaction to the police sirens, maybe? There was no sound, but it seemed like Maud had synced the videos perfectly. Do you remember Rogers said there were two couples on the bridge, coming from Dominic Street, from the Roisin Dove? Maud didn't wait for a reply, but clicked again, and the screen shifted. Look, you can see them arriving. And here. Another click. That's the single guy he mentioned, coming from the other direction. She sat back and looked up. Jack is not there, Aisling. There's no sign of him. And where's the guy who made the supposed phone call? No sign of him at all. On the screen, the video came to an end, and another automatically started, showing the street again, this time from the other side. How on earth did you get all this? Maud shrugged. I started looking for cameras. The news agents had one, the bank across the road had one over the ATM, and the bridge mills had one. There were others further up and down the streets, and they're useful too, but not as close to the bridge. So what, you just asked and they handed them over? Some of them did. The news agents. The girl there was very helpful, Iraqi girl. Her parents were asylum seekers, came over after the coup. Her brother owns the place, but he was away. She had to call him to find out how to make a copy of the footage for me. Maud was shaking her head again. Maud, what? Sorry, yes. Well, the newsagent girl gave me her footage, which was encouraging. The bank was a bit more challenging, but I got there in the end. And the Bridge Mills uses a security firm. The guy there was happy enough to give me a copy of their film for a few quid. Christ almighty. I can't believe this.